I have had to rely on the goodness of colleagues that are interested and willing to work with us. There is no reward system built for doing this. There's no time off or anything else. What we have are just four simple guidelines that are written for them right now. They have to identify a scientific problem, and they've got to work with a scientist. I send out a survey to the arts and science and to the ag faculty, and I tell them what I'm trying to do. And they write back any projects that they might want help with. I make a list of those. I hand it out to my students. I say, here are the contacts. Here are the projects that you could make contact. See if this will work for you. They then go and meet with a faculty member, and they start to work in the lab. There's a requirement of at least 45 hours involved. I prefer actually a summer experience where you're dedicating 4 weeks of your time to the assignment. But we leave that somewhat up in the air for the teacher and the student to work out what it's all about. They then are to prepare a paper and the references with that, and they're to deliver it in a professional forum. And we make accommodations for the professional forum to occur if necessary. In many cases, if it really works, the professor puts them on board as part of the research team, and they go along to make the presentation at a professional forum within that field. And it's not just entomology, but we've had some wonderful experiences with the entomology faculty. I wish I had the kind of relationship with the rest of the faculty at the university that I do with entomology, but I don't. We'll keep working on that. Now, the word collaboration is a really crucial word in this thing. You don't just stick two people in a room and say, well, you both agree this is the problem, go to it, and expect anything to happen of value. Collaborations require several things. First of all, it really is a team. And I've been lucky enough originally to work with real teachers on masters that had to have some kind of research experience. And so there was more of a collaboration because they're a little older. The faculty member felt like they were maybe colleagues in some capacity, even though they didn't have a background. But we've got to have some kind of relationship, because this person comes in, it's a short period of time, and you have to learn to dance quickly. And we don't have a lot of time to make mistakes. And I would say the biggest failure I had early on was assuming that I said, well, go talk to Marion, and this will be a good thing. And without setting the stage for that. Setting the stage, I'm going to come back to this number one and how you develop an effective team, or at least some suggestions. The next thing is that there's got to be clear expectations as to what really is expected here. And laid out, summarized, written down. Thirdly, time frames and subsets of specific accomplishments. For example, Marion and others, Blair, has had them actually, the first thing they had is they said, I need you to put about 20 hours in at the library and with this material. This is what you need to really understand before we can do something. Well, that's okay. They need to understand the background information associated with it. And so they've put them on lit reviews and a reading assignment to get things going. So what fell? Very large insect. And lastly, endpoints. You know, this is beautiful. None of you are ever going to be finished with your research. I hate to tell you this, but you're going to die before your research is done. And I want kids to understand that, but at the same time, I want some kind of closure associated with this project. So we've got to actually identify what it is that will be the nature of the endpoint when they're working with this stuff. Where do you finish it? Now, if they want to continue, that's another matter. But there has to be, these are the things we wanted to accomplish, we've accomplished them. Some kind of endpoint. Next, I want to talk briefly about this teaming. I have had some teams fail when I put a student with a researcher. I know this will be sort of hard to take, and maybe some of you won't believe it, but some researchers are really not very good communicators. My students would say they're really not even nice people. At any rate, we've used some instruments so that this dance goes faster. I've used some personal preference instruments so that we know each other's working styles and something about our behaviors. I want to show you just one page from this 21-page printout that I use. It's a DISC, if any of you are in the business world. And so this would be my perception of self that comes out of the instrument. And you know, I really like those descriptions. I think they sort of tell it all, you know. And then there are other people like you in the audience that are actually seeing my body language, listening to me describe my research agenda for them, and this is what's going through their mind. And then, you know, it's almost Christmas. It's the end of the semester. And I have a very, very busy schedule. Therefore, I'm a little bit stressed. And when I meet with the student, this is what they see. And, of course, all of those are wrong. Well, they're not really wrong. I mean, I am right. And there's no use, we don't have time to beat around the bush, so I'm pretty direct. Okay, now we've got something to work with. This is not an excuse for my behavior, but it is an explanation so that we can start to figure out how to work with each other. There are pages in the printout that talk about how the quality of work. I actually am a big picture person. That gets in my way, and I actually have graduate students that work with me that are very detail-oriented, and we work out the fact that I'm going to work with big picture, you fill in the details. If you want me to do the details, we're in trouble, because I'm already moved on to something else. And we had that worked out. We really laid that out. They know their job, I know my job. It isn't that I can't do detail, I prefer not to, and if I don't have to, I'm happier. And you already saw when I'm not happy. All right, so why work with future science teachers? We've gone over and really heard a lot of it today. In fact, the last quote that you had from a student, I think, said it all in terms of his perception of what he got from you and why it was crucial to his own professional future and his own students. Number one, I'm really convinced that simply taking courses and getting A's in them and filling out a transcript is not providing them with an understanding of science, folks. Science is a process, not a product. Science is a set of worldviews that you have to understand at a level that you simply can't get out of a lecture and passing tests. We've got to have kids experience the muddiness of research, the grayness of research. They do represent the pipeline. Our science teachers are the first round at getting kids excited about science and sending them to you. And that's crucial. I really have never had a student in my secondary science class that could not name a particular teacher that influenced their decision to be in that room with me. So the first round, and many times it was professors. It wasn't necessarily a high school teacher or junior high teacher. But it was a person that got them excited about science. So adding to the pipeline. Some of my teachers belong in research. And this is both good and bad. I do have people that get excited about research, and I lose them. I think that's okay. My job is really not to force somebody down a career path, but to open opportunities for people to be all they can be, whatever that might be. The other thing that goes to mind, though, when I read that statement, I have some students I would prefer be in a lab and away from people. So maybe not the kind of research you do, but certainly they're not necessarily, their skill set doesn't match teaching. Okay, so, and lastly, we really have this national movement that has not taken hold. The movement is that we are supposed to be preparing teachers and preparing a citizenry that are critical thinkers and problem solvers. And then in light of that, we want our science teachers to then actually be doing inquiry. National standards clearly stated, teacher preparation standards I showed you a moment ago clearly stated. And yet, as I also stated, it's not happening in our schools. They're not doing science. They're not doing the activities, they're not engaging the kids in the nature of science or inquiry. And I'm convinced they're not doing it because they've never done it. And we've just got to change that. That's all there is to it. And The last comment, see that and down here? It's like, ooh, there's one more thing. And here's what I'm thinking. See, there's a paradigm shift that takes place. It's like the student that was in my class tearfully last week. He's at least thinking that what I'm describing for teaching is not what he's experienced. And he's scared. Now, being aware of that, we can work with him. I see some faculty members, a good friend of ours, has been involved in preparing teachers. He teaches an Earth Systems course, and he's a lifelong learner. He's one of the good guys. You know him. All of you. You're here because you care about teaching. Dave wanted to try some things with his students, but he feels a little insecure. I mean, he feels pretty good with his content. He's been lecturing for 20-plus years, and he's good at it. Well, we talked about all these things and inquiry, and so, okay, well, I'm going to get the kids involved in doing some projects in my class. My lab is right across the hall from my office, and he uses my lab for one of his classes. So he comes into my office, and he says, okay, they're doing a project today, and I've got them in groups. What do I do? He said, I usually lecture about this material, and I really don't know what to do. I really feel uncomfortable, and I feel like I'm failing because I'm not teaching. And you've heard this, and we have colleagues that truly believe the paradigm shift hasn't occurred. You see, those that do the doing do the learning. Right now, I'm really happy with what I've learned about this presentation today. I haven't a clue what you've learned. Those that do the doing do the learning. The other part, though, with Dave and the paradigm shift is that Marion and I are part of a Thursday night investment club. We used to just get together on Thursday nights to watch soccer and drink beer, but it really did sound a little fishy that at 9:30 at night you show up at a bar and drink beer and watch soccer. And so we changed it into an investment club where everybody gives a dollar to Joe and he buys a lottery ticket. Now we've lost about $400 that way, but that'll be tax deductible when we win, so we keep track of it. One Thursday night, Dave comes in with this portfolio, three-ring binder, to investment club. He sets down and opens it up. He says, you won't believe this. I didn't give a test this semester. At the end of the semester, I had portfolios, and they had to show me what they learned. Look at what she learned. Look at the stuff in here. He's forcing everybody to look at what this student put in their portfolio and the evidence they had collected. And I don't know how many of us take our tests from a student to a group in a social setting to show the performance of our students. But he was excited. This was the first time he had used authentic assessment. He was excited by what could come out when you ask students to do real work and to show what they were learning. I think that also is something that I'd really like you to hang on this last page of summary, doing real work. You see, your life in your research agenda is real work. We have taken that away from many of our students. They have not had the opportunity to do real work, real science. And if we can capture that and have them understand the joy of real science and real work, you got them hooked for a lifetime. It's like my daughter when she was about 5 years old. My wife's an artist, and so we sort of fight between these two worldviews. And we're in the car, and she says, Daddy, you're right. Science is everywhere. And that made my day. So with that, I would love to just answer any questions you might have about this thing called getting science teachers involved. Yeah.
Well, probably being one of the oldest people here, I just feel history. When I actually took a double master's, one of my master's was in science education. 43 years ago, we were taught inquiry.
I don't know. See, I'm a little older, too, and so there was some PhD student recently sent me this survey. He sent it three times because I didn't respond the first two, so I finally responded. The question was, I want you to tell me the most succinct and critical lit reviews and lit articles from the last 20 years that have been revolutionary in science education. And I wrote back and I said, I'll tell you why I didn't respond to your survey the first two times. I can't think of anything in the last 20 years that's occurred other than somebody trying to publish a new definition of an old term. And so they've come up with some lovely vocabulary that we can throw at each other, but the fact is what you need to do is go back to Dewey and do what he told us to do, and we'll be perfectly fine by just implementing what we knew 100 years ago. That's the sad part. I did a lit review a number of years ago on what science education was saying 100 years ago. This was right at the turn of the century. This is from South Africa in 1899. Never teach indoors what can be taught outdoors. Curriculum is a lot like a bought-in suit. It never fits well. Now, those are quotes from 100 years ago. So doing it is, you know, we've been knowing it. But I think we feel uncomfortable. It's like Dave coming over to my class. They just feel uncomfortable. It's not what they're used to. It's a paradigm shift. Thank you.
I'm a PhD student with Dr. Michael Perella at UC Davis, and I'm very happy to be here. I'll try to get through all these slides. I think I have too many slides, but I'll try to keep us on schedule. So we all think of coccinellas as predators, and in fact, nearly 90% of the 6,000 species, some species are predators. And because of that, they're widely used as biological control agents. And of course, we know they prey mostly on Hemiptera, Sternorhynchia, but also we find other prey items, thrips and mites. And coccinellas are interesting. You can think of them kind of as the founders of classical biological control. You know, we have this classical example of the Vidalia beetle being released in California to combat cottony cushion scale. But then, what about mycophagy? There are mycophagous coccinellids, and most of them that have been described, all of them that have been described to my knowledge, are in this subfamily of the coccinellinae. So, as we heard earlier, a lot of the coccinellinae are facultative mycophages, but there's actually a tribe, the Halizaini, previously known as Siluburini, that are all obligate mycophages. And it's interesting to look that within that tribe, we have several genera, and they are in fact cosmopolitan. So you find these mycophagous coccinellids all over the world, in fact, in temperate environments, in Mediterranean environments, in tropical and subtropical environments. Now there's some contention here with the phylogenetics of this clade, and some members of this Halizaini tribe have been suggested to belong to the Coccinellini, which suggests that they're very closely related indeed. So Ilias is sometimes considered to reside within Coccinellini, and recently this genus Prototheia was moved to Coccinellini. So all of these within the Halizaini are obligate mycophages, but some of them have been moved to Coccinellini. So now we have obligate mycophages in Coccinellini. So let's talk about the tribe a little bit. Again, the cosmopolitan, previously known as Siluburini. They're all small ladybird beetles, 2 to 5 millimeters. And as far as we know, they're all obligate consumers of a specific type of fungi, powdery mildew fungi. And this is, again, an obligation at all life stages. And it's been recorded that they feed on the conidia fores, and also the hyphae of these fungi. So again, I just wanted to point out the cosmopolitan nature of this tribe. We find them all over the place, New World, Old World. And I think that's very interesting. Everywhere we have powdery mildew, we tend to have these little beetles. So I came across this in the literature when I was preparing for this talk, and it seems that it's been hypothesized that all coccinellids have a mycophagous ancestry. And the hypothesis here is that food preferences have changed within the Serilinoidea from fungi to sooty mold, a type of fungi. And then since we're eating sooty mold, right there in the proximity of the sooty mold, there's Hemiptera. So this has, this is the hypothesis of how this evolutionary change has come about. And now it looks like within the coccinellids, we have a reversion to mycophagy. So let's talk a little bit about powdery mildew. Powdery mildew are all obligate plant parasites, and we find them all over the world as well. They're very important plant pests, or plant diseases, I should say. It's interesting that even though they have such a wide host range as a group of fungi, each powdery mildew species tends to be pretty host specific. And we're interested as plant managers in powdery mildew because, of course, it can affect aesthetic properties of the plants and crops that we're dealing with, and we can actually have yield reductions and plant loss. So typically powdery mildew is managed chemically, and this presents problems for us in the way of cost, of course, lost production time in the form of re-entry intervals, non-target effects when we're using fungicides, and then of course resistance in the organism that we're trying to control here, the powdery mildew. So all of these problems lead us to the consideration of biological control. And there are already several commercially available microbial agents out there, but only recently we have begun to evaluate the potential for arthropods to deliver an ecological service of powdery mildew.